Welcome to The Breach Show, featuring incisive analysis of politics and social movements in Canada. I'm your host, Emma Paling, and my guest today is Breach Managing Editor Martin Lukacs. Martin was just at the NDP's policy convention in Hamilton this past weekend. How was it, Martin? Did you have more fun at this one or the Conservative convention?
Well, politics aside, NDPers definitely party harder.
Interesting.
The Tory convention was a much more buttoned-up, tame affair. You know, to paraphrase Emma Goldman, if I can't dance, it's not my social democratic reformation. And I would say, I guess for, you know, many people, the situation in Gaza and Israel, which I know we'll talk about later, kind of hung over the conference. So in many ways, that set the mood.
So the NDP is more fun, but the timing in terms of world events was definitely less fun. And just as the convention was starting, this is not surprising, but another new poll came out showing that the Conservatives have a huge lead over the Liberals. It's a 14 percentage point lead at this point. If there was an election anytime soon, the Conservatives would win a crushing majority. Was that on people's minds as well?
Definitely. I think it's been keenly felt by party members and definitely also the party's operatives. Not only are the Tories, you know, crushing the Liberals in the polls, but they're also peeling off a significant chunk of NDP, typical NDP voters. I think it's something like 10, the latest poll said it was about 10% of previous NDP voters are thinking to vote Conservative. And NDP officials in the kind of on background political briefing that journalists attended at the start said that the party would test drive messages during the campaign, the language that they might take into the next campaign. And it really marked, I think, a shift to fully attacking Poilievre, Pierre Poilievre, the Conservative leader, on the assumption that the Liberals are kind of a spent force and that Poilievre is the kind of, you know, PM in waiting. So we heard a lot of language about how he's a fake, a fraud, a threat to working people, Indigenous, trans people, women, labor unions. Not to, you know, toot our own horn immodestly, but I do think a lot of the language, you know, is similar to the language that the Breach has been putting out in our own coverage for, you know, a year and a half now.
Let's play a clip from Jagmeet Singh's speech where he was going after Poilievre specifically.
So you see, for Pierre Poilievre, it's all an act. He pretends to care, but he doesn't know how regular people actually live. Pierre Poilievre doesn't want to help. He just wants power. And he will use that power the same way Conservatives always use their power, to make the rich richer and to take away every bit of dignity from working people.
What do you think of that speech?
Well, look, I think they're definitely finally hitting some of the right notes, but the shift is coming rather late. You know, Poilievre has had the time to establish himself as the, you know, fake populist choice in this country. He's been churning out videos and campaigning across the country, and he's been really successfully connecting with people's anger and disenchantment. You know, I had a conversation with a Conservative strategist in Quebec City at that Conservative convention last month, and they're keenly aware that they have had this time to basically eat the NDP's lunch. You know, one strategist told me that, you know, they were in Northern Ontario with Poilievre, and it's evident to them that people want a Bernie Sanders-like figure on the left to speak to that anger about inequality and cost of living. But she said, you know, if they don't get it from a Bernie Sanders on the left, they'll take it from a Pierre Poilievre on the right. So I think the NDP kind of party brass who really make the decisions in the party, they have been rudderless and they haven't really known how to respond, and they've been floundering as a result. And I think now they've started to find their way to the right answer. But for one thing, the rhetoric is just simply not as compelling as what Poilievre is putting out. You know, Poilievre, you know, talks about Trudeau. Like, he's just got great lines. Trudeau is, you know, isn't serving the have-nots. He's serving the have-yachts. He talks about people having to choose between heating and eating. You know, the kind of rhetoric by comparison that we have from Singh in this speech is like, frankly, like junior high persuasion. So that's, I think, an issue. And the truth is also that I don't think Jagmeet Singh is a very compelling messenger of this kind of politics. You know, when he was first elected, I think the party was trying to play the politics of personality following on the model of Trudeau, you know, like there were the Hopi slogans, the, you know, boasts about boxing or wrestling skills and how he could, like, you know, take on Trudeau in the ring. You know, they made a show of like public access to very candid private moments like his Jagmeet Singh's wedding and wedding proposal. The problem was that those were already part of Justin Trudeau's playbook. And I don't think they really found traction with people. Now they've shifted belatedly and they're trying to reinvent him as a left populist, you know? But it, I don't think it clicks. And I think one reason is that Jagmeet Singh, who, you know, the well-dressed lawyer who loves the ostentatious symbols of wealth, has always frankly appeared more to be an, more of an aspirant to the elite than an opponent of them. And I think he's like trying his best to frankly play the part now, but his biggest problem is that Pierre Poilievre is just a much better actor.
Let's talk about resolutions a little bit. So they represent policies that NDP members want, but Jagmeet Singh doesn't actually have to follow them, does he?
Yeah, it's funny. Like all the other political parties whose conventions I've attended, you know, the conventions are supposed to be exercises in party democracy, but they almost always get kickstarted with party officials or the leader disavowing that democracy. So as we heard from the, you know, party officials in that briefing in the first morning, they made very clear that they are not bound by resolutions. I mean, not to get into too much, but party, like with the NDP, for instance, it's party members and in riding associations put forward resolutions, but that doesn't necessarily guarantee that they're going to be prioritized in a way that that they'll actually get onto the convention floor. So there's a lot of, like, you know, chicanery and machination behind the scenes whereby party officials often uprank the resolutions they would prefer to have debated and downrank those that they may view as a threat for being too radical. There has been a lot of, you know, pushback from grassroots members of the NDP over the years. There was a resolution passed at the last convention that led to a change in how convention resolutions are prioritized. So there was, you know, an online kind of voting system, though there was no independent scrutineer to check the results or to supervise the results. And that led to a supposedly more democratic accounting for where resolutions end up. You know, the thing about conventions is that they are spectacles, you know, highly stage managed affairs, and they're much more stage managed than they used to be. I think over the last 20 years or so, starting especially under Jack Layton, conventions became, for the NDP in particular, became much more about like wheeling out the leader, displaying him and the, you know, maybe the caucus members and upcoming candidates, and far less about genuine policy debate. You know, we've seen conventions like in 2016 when the Leap Manifesto was passed that then, you know, was absolutely jettisoned by the party leadership because they had no interest in pursuing it, even though it was passed by a majority of the membership. And that happens a lot.
So that's interesting then that the top emergency resolution, as you've just said, this indicates that the party was somewhat comfortable with it being passed at least. And the top emergency resolution was on pharmacare. So we're expecting legislation from the Liberals at some point soon. And this resolution said, quote, the NDP will publicly declare that continued confidence in supply is contingent on government legislation that clearly commits to a universal, comprehensive, and entirely public pharmacare program. So if the confidence in supply deal is contingent on that, that means that NDP members might want the party to collapse the government and force an election if we don't get that type of legislation from the Liberals. But bold new universal programs that are entirely public are not the type of policy we normally see from Justin Trudeau's Liberals. So what does that resolution actually mean?
Such a cynic, Emma. No, that's exactly right. Liberals don't exactly of their free will, you know, put forward bold new universal social programs. So I think in this case, this was an excellent resolution that was put forward by a grassroots member and backed up by a little bit of grassroots organizing, and it was prioritized number one. I think it was something that was welcomed by the caucus and by, you know, the MP Don Davies, who you know, has this under his portfolio and has been negotiating with the Liberals on pharmacare. I think that, you know, that this the resolution was passed unanimously, and it was a great way to provide a bit of leverage to the NDP to push for that, because as we understand it from media reports, the Liberals are not prepared to give a single payer universal public pharmacare program. They're following the model that the pharmaceutical companies have been pushing, which is a kind of fill in the gaps program that covers some of the 8 million Canadians who haven't got any coverage of any kind. But it wouldn't transform pharma care in this country by any means. And that's why the pharmaceutical lobby loves it so much, because it protects their inordinate profits and keeps drug prices quite high. So yeah, I think this was a useful move on the NDP's part. It was frustrating to see, though, that like immediately, instead of Jugmeet kind of and the party leadership skillfully using that leverage they had just been given by the party, immediately he told the media that he wouldn't say whether or not he would bring down the government over it. So it's like the party just gave you leverage and then he gave it away right away. So that was a bit frustrating to see. You'd think that they would, you know, more skillfully not concede that to the media and take that leverage back to negotiations with the government.
And especially because they would have known this resolution was coming, right? And they themselves prioritized it.
Exactly.
What about the other resolutions? Was there anything else interesting that passed?
Yeah, there was. There were a few resolutions that had been put forward by some of the union affiliates of the NDP, so the Steelworkers Union, that actually would have granted more power to the national director of the party and the federal council, which is the kind of governing body, the executive of the party. They would have granted them more power to make rules for the local EDAs, the electoral district associations. And interestingly, those were defeated. So it was a kind of like moment where the party's grassroots were kind of flexing their muscle. And frankly, that was really exciting to see, because generally speaking, the party membership is well to the left of where the kind of party brass and the leader are. And yet at this moment in time, there isn't really an organized left faction within the NDP. I think the NDP, because of its, you know, politics and attitude towards social movements, have ensured that most leftists aren't just no longer engaged in the party. I mean, there's you know, small pockets of activists who are doing things, but I think the fact that in spite of there not being an organized left formation in the party, there's still enough of a kind of collective understanding of the lopsided nature of the party, with too much power in the hands of the kind of consultants around Jagmeet, that they were able to kind of very vigorously vote down these resolutions. So I think that's a really positive sign for the life of the party, as it were. Sorry about the terrible unintended pun there. Yeah, so that was positive. There was an attempt by disability rights activists to ensure that who have, you know, had legitimate complaints that the party has not adapted like a hybrid way of organizing, which would allow people to attend and participate online and not expose themselves to COVID. And so there was a resolution that was a bit watered down, but it was still passed, which should send the message to the party that the next convention they hold should be a hybrid online in-person convention. So that was also an important kind of modest victory.
Well, you went to the convention and you do have a cough now.
It's true. It might have been my 1-year-old who got me sick.
Yeah, that's probably more likely. And now we obviously need to talk about the latest escalation in the Middle East and what's happening in Gaza. That must have been on people's minds at the NDP convention. And I know it was also on the agenda. How did that play out?
The NDP, I guess, over the last few years has kind of had like their politics and stances on Palestine have kind of gone through a few twists. I think with the latest like conflagration in the Middle East, the statement that the NDP put out initially was like equivocating. It actually suggested, for instance, that Hamas was to blame for Israeli bombing of Gaza, as if, you know, Israel hasn't several times relentlessly bombed or attacked Gaza before, not to mention the West Bank, where, you know, Hamas has never been in power. But Israel there's, you know, militarily occupying and arresting and killing Palestinians on a weekly basis. So that, I think, had angered a lot of activists within the party. And I think it was also a bit of a step backward considering the progress that the party had made over the last few years. So, like, you know, thanks to grassroots Palestinian solidarity activism. So there was a real, I mean, just to step back for a second, there was a real low under Thomas, former leader Thomas Mulcair. Mulcair used to talk about how in all situations, in all circumstances, he backs Israel. And he had, you know, muzzled and disciplined parliamentarians like Libby Davis, who regularly spoke out in support of Palestinian rights. So, you know, initially the party was kind of following on that legacy in 2018 at that the policy convention a few years ago. They organized, the party apparatus organized to stifle a very moderate resolution on Palestinian rights. And I think over the following years, they started to shift a little bit, in part because of pressure and in part because I think to more and more people around the world, what Israel is doing to the Palestinians is becoming more readily apparent, even though it shouldn't have taken that long. And so the resolution was passed at the last convention, and Jagmeet Singh has started to be more outspoken in support of Palestinian rights. For instance, he called for a few years ago, he called for an embargo on military exports to Israel from Canada. That was a positive step. So by Mulcair's former standards, things were better. By the standards of where international human rights groups are, who have called out, you know, Israel's apartheid regime, not so great. But I think the party was, unlike in previous conventions where they've tried to just like stifle that vote or out-organize it, this time they, I think thanks to the leadership maybe of some of the new caucus members, like Heather McPherson, who's the foreign policy critic, she seems to have a more reasonable position on the Middle East. And so there was a party sanctioned resolution that was put forward by her that I think was intended to preempt something more radical coming from the floor, but it was decent and reasonable. It denounced all attacks on civilians and called for an end to Israeli bombing and ceasefire. And I do think distinguishes the party from the other parties who have just been backing Israeli aggression full tilt. So that was put forward and it passed, you know, with a strong majority. So I think that set a better tone. But I think it will still leave a lot of people dissatisfied, certainly myself included, the party's not taking a more forceful position that really recognizes the woeful asymmetry in power and violence in Israel and Palestine. And I think we saw a little bit of that anger at the convention when there were some young Palestinian activists who tried to get into the kind of convention hall for a protest. And there were, you know, some scuffles with the security as they tried to kind of break through a security line to get in. And I was, you know, glad to see that they were able to speak their piece and got media coverage. So I do think the party has a long way to go to truly have a principled and progressive line on the Middle East.
So we've been talking a lot about how the NDP has responded to Israel's siege of Gaza, but what about the liberals who are actually in power? What's their response to this?
Well, I think it's been pretty much encouraging Israel to act with impunity. You know, the liberals dispatched Melanie Joly, Foreign Affairs Minister, to Israel last week to, like, you know, lend the government support in person, you know, just as Israel was planning to force 1 million Palestinians out of their homes in Gaza. And after the collective, you know, punishment, the deprivation of electricity and water and gas had commenced. I think the liberals have taken a kind of business as usual approach with this government in Israel, even though it's a coalition of right-wing and extreme right-wing parties who openly talk about annexing the West Bank, and even some of the members talk about expelling, you know, Palestinians.
Yeah, and I think a question that a lot of people have is, what's the bigger picture in terms of Canada's relationship to Israel? In the past years leading up to this, how has Canada been propping up the Israeli government?
Well, look, like every now and then the Canadian government issues some bland statement of concern, you know, about what Israel's doing, but it backs Israeli state aggression fully, you know, in line with the United States. So, you know, Trudeau will rhetorically, you know, oppose the illegal settlements that have encroached on Palestinian land, but don't actually take any action to deter Israel from continuing to expand them. You know, they call for peace and security, but then they continue with the policies that make that impossible. So, I mean, let me name a few. The Trudeau government has permitted the export of some $20 million annually of military equipment. There's explosives, military aircraft equipment. It's expanded the Canada-Israel Free Trade Agreement, which gives products made in the illegal Israeli settlements in the West Bank preferential access to the Canadian market. They've, you know, legally intervened to stop the accurate labeling of Israeli wines imported from those illegal settlements. They have, you know, advocated against the International Criminal Court investigating past Israeli war crimes in Gaza. They've voted against countless UN resolutions that are upholding Palestinian rights. I think at the latest count, something like 60, while the liberals have been in power. It has, you know, participated in training and providing military personnel to the force that helps the Palestinian Authority, that's the government in the West Bank, police its own people. You know, Israel for many years has basically outsourced the occupation to the Palestinian Authority, and Canada's complicit in that. You know, in 2018, Chrystia Freeland, when she was foreign affairs minister, announced, and Canada was trying to, you know, win a seat at the UN Security Council, she said quite explicitly that Canada would aim to be an asset for Israel on the council. And I think they have shown that they've been doing that the last few years. And in many ways, very, very little space between them and what Stephen Harper was doing when it came to Israel. So it's been a continuous bipartisan support for Israeli colonization and daily violence against the Palestinians. And I think any Canadians that hope for justice and peace in the Middle East have a responsibility to push the Canadian government's position to change.
Yeah, and in the media, on the big broadcasts and newspapers in Canada, we've seen a lot of, like, you know, repetition of politicians saying that they support Israel, but not a lot of context about the impact on Palestinians of that Canadian involvement. The media coverage in general has been pretty one-sided. Let's play a clip of an interview that was on CBC with the Palestinian ambassador, Mona Abu Amara.
Listen, why is it the job of the Occupy to come and condone or condemn or protect the security of its occupier? You're talking about 2 million people held hostage in the largest open-air prison being bombed continuously for the past decade.
I guess my point is Israel does have a right to defend itself, and there are now more than 600 people dead.
When you say Israel has the right to defend itself, and that has been going on for so long, yeah, even when atrocities have been happening to the Palestinians, and then do Palestinians have the right to defend themselves? And why not?
I think it's pretty classic one-sided interrogation, which is generally, I think, what Palestinian voices have experienced when they're very infrequently allowed to get a platform on the Canadian mainstream media. Yeah, I think generally the Canadian, you know, public broadcaster and the corporate media follow very closely the parameters on foreign policy set by, you know, the Canadian government. And if anything, they often act as kind of the foot soldiers reinforcing the political consensus that, you know, Palestinians should take what's coming to them. I mean, to speak personally, my own politicization as a journalist and as an activist actually relates to this. Like when I was 20, I went to Israel and then went to the occupied territories as an activist and worked with the International Solidarity Movement, which is a Palestinian-led campaign that does nonviolent action against the military occupation, you know, trying to remove illegal roadblocks, you know, that Israel, you know, places in the West Bank to cut off Palestinian access to roads or their own land. And I remember what was striking is like that experience itself wasn't really what politicized or radicalized me. It was coming back to Canada after having spent time in Palestine. And I would just be reading like the Globe and Mail and, you know, mainstream newspapers in Canada and just be so struck by the chasm between the myths of the conflict and the reality of it that I had seen with my own eyes. You know, the daily relentless violence that a military occupation has on Palestinians. And it really just seared into my understanding the kind of amoral, like, servility that the establishment media has when it comes to Palestine and Israel.
There's one other story this week that we should definitely talk about, which is the situation with MPP Sarah Jama in Ontario. She's a new NDP member of provincial parliament that just got elected this year. She put out a statement that did not mention Hamas's attack, but it did echo what international organizations have long said about Israeli occupation of the Palestinian territories. And now she's facing this really extreme move by Doug Ford's conservatives to silence her and stop her from speaking at all in the legislature. Have you ever seen a reaction like that play out in Canadian politics before?
I mean, not that I can think of, but it's definitely not unique to see, you know, pretty remorseless and vicious attacks on high profile people who speak up for Palestine. You know, she, as soon as she kind of raised her hand to run for office during the last Ontario election, she was immediately, you know, smeared as an anti-Semite. Smears that were, you know, based on admittedly vague but entirely legitimate comparisons that she was making between police violence worldwide and Israeli violence against the Palestinians. And those were manipulated and deployed against her, and then given credence by outlets like the Toronto Star. And she was, you know, elected all the same, but the party at the time actually made her apologize. I think that was a real mistake, because it reinforced that false narrative and meant that, you know, when she put out a statement calling out Israeli apartheid recently, that media narrative was only further consolidated. You know, it has to be said that, you know, she hasn't always done herself favors in terms of the framing and wording of her statements, but she's undoubtedly principled and brave and definitely not an anti-Semite. It's wild to think, like, you know, when you have an administration that is being investigated by the RCMP for potential criminal offenses, who've engaged in such brazen corruption, that they have the ability to put a muzzle on a young Muslim first-time member of parliament who has done nothing wrong. And as we report in the piece, the NDP is finally stiffening its spine, I think perhaps a bit late, and trying to defend her. So that's good to see. I only wish that they had found that will earlier.
Yeah, and it's also sad to see how the Ford government's, like, attempt to distract from its own problems and the RCMP investigation, it has worked. Like, there's stories now about the Sarah Jama quote-unquote scandal every day by Queen's Park reporters who, if they weren't writing about that, would be writing about the Green Belt, the RCMP investigation. The NDP is calling for additional investigations, and those would be the headlines otherwise.
Yeah, how disappointingly easy it seems to be to lure the journalist class from the real targets.
Well, thanks, Martin, for being our first guest on the Revived Breach show. If you like what you heard, please subscribe to the podcast or to our YouTube channel at The Breach. And if you want to support our work, become a sustaining member at breachmedia.ca/support. Thanks for listening.